IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Aditya Ramanathan. Before we begin, I'd like to mention that the Takshashila Institution is conducting an exercise we call India's Global Outlook Survey. The aim of the survey is to gauge what people think India's priorities in its foreign policy ought to be. You can check out our survey by just clicking on the link in the description and let us know your views. We'd love to hear from you. Now, coming on to today's episode, I'm joined by my namesake, Aditya Parikh. And what we want to discuss today, once again, is space. Now, we at the Takshashila Institution have been arguing for a while that India badly needs an overall strategy for space. Such a strategy would address the entire approach that India has to space. A key question it would answer would be, what role do we believe space has to play in the building of overall national power? And with that answered, it would lay out how this could be achieved. Now, just to be clear, this is actually a fairly profound question, and we don't have answers to it yet. But what's clear is that at least some governments are moving ahead with space strategies of their own. The most recent one comes from the UK, and it's not short on ambition at all. It mentions some key goals, growing the space economy, promoting what it calls an open and stable international order, supporting R&D, defending national interests, which brings in the strategic dimension, and using space for global and national challenges like climate change. And this is in turn supposed to be supported by, you know, the fact that the UK's private space sector has been growing, that it has opportunities for international collaboration, and so on. But I want to get to some of the details of this with Aditya Parikh, who's actually carefully read through the document. So Aditya, can you give us a bit of a background on what prompted the document to come out now? And who is this document really aimed at?
Be glad to, Aditya, and it's great to be back on the show. So this document actually builds on the UK's Integrated Review and Defence Command paper publications that came out earlier this year. So that to tangent is exactly what this document is also following. It's absolutely a whole of government kind of a strategy, not just limited to one or two departments, including defense or telecom, which you would think something about space when you're looking at to Earth to space, which you mostly this document is about. So you would think it would be limited to them. But I believe the phrasing is exactly government will take a whole ecosystem approach. So they've also roped in the private space sector in the UK as well. The document also mentions that to the same would reflect in their procurement to policies as well. They'll go for dual use capabilities, and they've mentioned the caveat that whilst ensuring that each capability would fully meet its core requirements. So that means they wouldn't skimp on the actual capability being delivered by that platform. So it's not like to make compromises and take the brunt for something. So the compromise that they come up with in these dual-use technologies would have a minimum level at which the competence has to be delivered. So that's what I take from it. It's also worth mentioning that the UK has a space command currently led by an Air Force officer, an Air Vice Marshal, if I recall correctly. But from what I understand, their capabilities are mostly intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, not really offensive capabilities in space. So they're still in the orbit to situational awareness and Earth to orbit to situational awareness phase, as far as I understand. So the document also makes reference to the new space race and Galactic Britain, although the Galactic Britain part is only from Boris Johnson's foreword, the Prime Minister's foreword. So it's not really a serious assertion. And I don't think if Boris Johnson were not to be in power, it would actually matter much to the next government, or I don't know. It's very political. It's not really substantive in the strategy kind of a way. So I think overall, this document recognizes that access to space has to be secured for the prosperity of the nation. So UK is talking about its populace. So to answer the very specific part of your question, that who is this document really addressing? So I think it's addressing the general public and not really making stratifications in who's going to read what part. So I think it's pretty understandable from a layman's perspective, and the general members of the public are supposed to be swayed by the arguments in it. I think at Takshashila, we've also made similar arguments in our own recent discussion documents about the Artemis Accords and should India join them, and our unique discussion document exploring space as a geopolitical environment. So I think we'll link them both in the description, and to our listeners, please feel free to check them out. Send us feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you brought up those documents, Aditya, because one thing that researching, especially spaces of geopolitical environment, has done is that I've become sort of allergic to a lot of these cliches that end up landing in these space strategy and doctrine documents of several major states. You see less of that in this particular document. There is a sense that they've engaged with the literature more, that they've really thought about what they're saying and what the implications of that is. Now, one thing where obviously they haven't thought through the implications is Galactic Britain. That's obviously political, as you pointed out. It's something that you imagine Boris Johnson would say with a smirk or a twinkle in his eye. You know, it's like Britannia rules the orbits. Moving on, you know, what are some of the, getting to specifics, what are some of the operational goals or aspirations in the document? You know, are there some key points that caught your attention, for example?
Yeah, definitely. There are some. So they acknowledge that active debris removal and in-orbit servicing of satellites and other space objects are key areas that are emerging for private enterprise and national enterprise to develop capabilities in. There's even a reference to in-orbit manufacturing using robotics and 3D printing. Now, that is strange to me, because given the state of that technology, 3D printing specifically right now, here on the surface, I really don't think that's viable right now, because of how slow that technology is and how delicately it has to be handled. So I don't think the hostile environment in outer space is ever going to be very conducive to that. They acknowledge the role of the private enterprise in the new space. There's a specific quote I'd like to mention from the document. It says, ensuring innovative space businesses can access private finances through space-oriented venture capital funds, such as a Seraphim Space Investment Trust supported by the British Business Bank. I think that's a very good idea. Even if I don't understand the very nitty-gritties of the finances being mentioned here, but I definitely can get behind the concept of a government actually setting up a fund like that for venture capital to be invested in new space companies. And I think this is a step that even India should look into. And another thing that caught my eye about investment, so they've set a target for the total R&D spending to constitute about 2.4% of their GDP by the year 2027. So as far as I understand, this is overall, not just space, but space is going to figure majorly into it. So if India could, you know, set aside a percentage of its GDP in its budget for R&D, which I think we'd all agree that we sorely need in all sorts of different sectors, not just defense, not just space, just about everywhere we need money for R&D. And I think we've argued that for a long time. They've also highlighted how specific high-tech missions would benefit their space capabilities. So I think they're looking at sample return missions from Mars to Earth. And there's even another one for monitoring the sun for space weather events like solar flares. That you know, people are thinking in terms of, you know, charting the poles for learning about the weather on Terra. But these folks are thinking in terms of, you know, charting the solar flares. So I think that's a long shot, but something that could be useful scientific knowledge-wise. The document also has considerable references to counter-space capabilities. So militarization of space is not really an elephant in the room either. They've addressed it, I think. They don't specifically use the term militarization of space or counter-space capabilities, but they talk about how their adversaries, how they focus on ASAT capabilities, both kinetic and non-kinetic. So the non-kinetic ones are more profound from what I understand text has. They talk about jamming, cyber attacks, dazzling, and, well, also kinetic, ASAT missiles, which India also has. And they talk about to perceive threats and damages that can be caused to their fortunes, the UK's fortunes, for a targeted attack on their space assets were to materialize. So I'm quoting specifically, in the unlikely event the UK were deprived of access to global navigation satellite systems, for example, the impact on our economy could be as high as £5.2 billion lost in just 5 days.
Aditya, I think it's really significant that they do talk about, for example, the risk, however small it might seem today, of being deprived of a global satellite navigation system, talking about counter space capabilities. You know, while missions to Mars and so on are aspirational, the more immediate challenge in space for all states is really space applications, what space means for our economies, for our societies, and for strategy back on Earth. Now, I want to come back after a very quick break to talk about how the UK might engage with other countries based on its national space strategy. So we'll just take a very short break, folks. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. We're discussing the UK's national space strategy. Now, Aditya, we've gone over some of the key aspects of the strategy, and you do get a sense throughout that the UK is looking for international cooperation in space. Can you highlight some instances in the document that reflects this? What is the UK's approach? You know, this is a country that has exited the European Union, for example. What sort of cooperation are they looking for with the European Space Agency?
I'm glad you brought that up, because there's a lot of stuff about international cooperation in the document. So about the who is this document targeted at question, I think also the international audience, not just the domestic audience, and especially the partners that they have signed up with. So starting with the EU, as you mentioned, the document highlights that the UK is still very dependent on the European Space Agency, and how many of its goals in space are still tied to its bilateral and multilateral engagements internationally in general. So the UK is participating in the Horizon Europe and Copernicus programs for Earth observation and scientific research in general under the UK-EU Trade and Cooperation Agreement post-Brexit. There was also a G7 meeting earlier this year in June, if I recall correctly, in Cornwall. They had committed to mitigating space debris, actively mitigating space debris with the other G7 member countries. So that's really something they highlight repeatedly in the document, getting rid of debris in orbit. So they also have the UK-Australia Space Bridge. They have signed the Artemis Accords and will be part of the Artemis program, which is supposed to return astronauts to the moon's surface, led by the US. And as I said, they've signed the Artemis Accords as well. So they're pretty much into the Western camp, obviously. They also mentioned the UN General Assembly resolution about figuring out a framework for internationally recognized responsible space behaviors. So I think there are 3 or 4 references to this specific concept in the document as well. So they are definitely looking to have a seat at the table where new rules of the road, so to say, or rules of the rocket, as you once said on one of our podcasts, are going to be figured out. So I think they've done a pretty good job of putting their case forward in multilateral and bilateral or whatever kind of international engagement about space. So one more thing, you remember how we've discussed the gray zone dual use drone tech before on this podcast about, if I recall correctly, drones, one of our episodes. So how off-the-shelf components can be used, I think, to build drones, which are those components are dual use. So
yeah.
So those components, I think, would be something for space technology as well that have to be, you know, regulated. So I think to address that sort of a concern, and I'm quoting from the document itself, the UK strategic export controls restrict the transfer of military and sensitive dual-use space technologies under appropriate international export control regimes, such as the Wassenaar Agreement. So the Wassenaar Agreement, to which India is also part of, IEJEC, on export controls for conventional arms and dual-use goods and technologies. And then the well-known missile technology control regime, which forbids a certain payload capacity after a certain ferry range for platforms across. So it could be anything, space launch vehicles, it could be UAVs, just about anything that carries this much. So that would be allowed to be exported in the sense that you can't transfer the technology for the manufacturing of such equipment. So you can actually, under MTCR, you can export the product itself, but you can't give another country the know-how and the facilities to build them. So this also had some bearing on our own space program, if I recall correctly, the GSLV launch vehicles. So the restrictions on space launch vehicles, satellite payload, space qualified components and ground segment equipment. And they're also looking at the downstream capabilities, the downstream activities of their space sector. They're also going to regulate that in some capacity from the wording, as I understand. So this could be maybe the companies that sell geospatial data or imagery, Earth observation imagery. So I think this could be quite significant in that sense.
Right. Yeah, there's actually a lot to unpack when you think about it, right? A national space strategy is such an ambitious document by its very nature that it will prompt more questions than it necessarily answers. I should also point out to our listeners that in the coming weeks, the UK is also expected to release a defense space strategy. So we're looking forward to checking that out as well. One thing about the UK and India is, you know, the governments are fairly alike in some of the ways that they function for obvious reasons. Another thing that makes the UK's national space strategy interesting to us is that both the UK and India are, in their own ways, middling space powers that rely on cooperation with others in order to really get a leg up in going into space. So to my mind, the UK's national space strategy really provides guideposts for us to think about how India can craft an overarching national space strategy of its own. And the two of us, Adityas, will, you know, continue to look up to the heavens and try and make sense of what's going on there and why it matters to us back on Earth. So thank you so much for talking to us about the UK's strategy, Aditya.
Thank you, Aditya, for hosting me.
And thank you all for joining us on All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.